I would like to welcome everyone to today's presentation. My name is Seth Zirpel. I'm an attorney here in Evansville, Indiana, with the firm of Condie, Zonovan & Kahn. Presently serve more or less in a leadership a committee role with our lawyers chapter here in Evansville. I am thrilled to introduce our speaker today and his topic. It is quite exceptional that we have the opportunity to have a presentation given on a topic with a practitioner who has firsthand experience working in the subject matter day in and day out of his professional and frankly personal life. As a side note, I had the pleasure of sitting next to our speaker back in November of 2021 at the Lawyers Convention in DC. Got to chatting about his line of work, and he graciously agreed to present. So here we are, how many months later, Omar holding up his end of the bargain, and I'm greatly appreciative of it. So today's presentation is on the application of the Constitution to the territories, and our speaker, who I'm thrilled to introduce, is Omar Andino, who served as the Deputy Solicitor General of Puerto Rico since January 2021. Under the supervision of the Solicitor General, he is currently in charge of all appellate litigation before the Puerto Rico Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court and the United States Courts Court of Appeals for the First Circuit and the Supreme Court of the United States. Before being appointed, Deputy Solicitor General, Omar worked in the Supreme Court of Puerto Rico for two justices and also in private practice at a medium-sized firm in Puerto Rico, handling commercial litigation matters in state and federal courts. While in law school, Omar received the Dean's Award and the Bar Association's Award for Highest GPA in his class. And he was also part of the Law Review and authored various law review articles concerning civil and criminal matters. Omar also holds an LLM from the University of Illinois, where he worked as a teaching assistant for Professor Sharp and contributed to his recently published textbook, Administrative Law, A Life Cycle Approach. Omar has been an active member of the Federal Society's Law School and currently serves as Vice President of the Puerto Rico Lawyers Chapter. Today's presentation format will be delivery of remarks by Omar. I would ask that everyone keep their microphones muted. Upon completion of his prepared remarks, we will open up the floor to questions. Due to the size of the group being fairly small, I would ask if you have a question to allow Omar or the previous speaker to conclude his or her statements or remarks, to unmute, to ask the question, and then to mute your mic again. We will conclude in any event by 1 p.m. Central. And with that, I'll open the floor to Omar. Thank you all.
Thank you very much, Seth. Let me see if I can share my screen first, just to get rid of the technical issues. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Successful share.
Perfect. Let me see here if I... it's going to be... it's a slideshow. Okay, perfect. Thank you very much, Seth, for the intro. For me, it's a pleasure to be here speaking to you today. And it's truly an honor, really, to be able to speak to of a topic that is really close to home. And again, I really thank Seth for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to be able to speak to you and to your chapter today. So I have drafted what I call an agenda. Obviously, I say it's an agenda, but it's kind of our goals here today. My goal is to really give a general idea about how the Constitution applies to the territories. Obviously, this is a really dense topic, and it has given rise to a lot of litigation, and it's obviously a really dense topic that I'm not able to cover in 40 minutes, but I have drafted this agenda, and I think that the broad question that you folks should be able to answer today is, how do the territories fit under the United States Constitution? How does that work? You hear all the time that the United States has territories, and obviously Puerto Rico is one of them. But I don't know if really when I was in law school, obviously we discussed that because we are part of that discussion. But textbooks don't really explain how the Constitution works in territories. And it's obvious that it should not apply as it applies in the mainland, right? So that's the general idea that I want to discuss today with you here. So first, I'll give a brief history surrounding the annexation of the territories after the Spanish-American War. And then I'm going to discuss the insular cases and its progeny. Obviously, I'm not going to discuss all of them. There's like 23, 24 cases, but I'm going to discuss the most important ones just for you folks to have an idea of what they say. And obviously, there's a lot of recent developments and debates surrounding the insular cases, and then I'll open the floor to questions. So the first thing we have to mention is, how did the United States acquire most of its territories? It happened around 1898 when the United States acquired Puerto Rico and, for example, acquired Hawaii and other territories after the Spanish-American War. As you may know, that war started when Cuban rebels were fighting for independence in Cuba. And after a warship called the Maine exploded in Cuba, President McKinley asked Congress for authorization to intervene in the war. And after the war ended, Puerto Rico was ceded to the United States. And it also included the Philippine Islands and Guam. That treaty, interestingly, was only ratified by one vote. So we are a territory for just one vote. But that's something that is interesting too. So this is something that I like to mention. What was the original goal of having territories for the US? The original goal, it's explained in Dred Scott. Obviously, that's a case that's discredited, and it's not a precedent anymore for the reasons that we all know. But there's a part of Dred Scott that's still it's still sounding today, and I think it's something that people don't discuss as much. Dred Scott said that the Constitution doesn't allow for a territory to be held in a permanently colonial manner. In other words, the Constitution does not allow for pieces of land to remain as territories forever. And that's something, right? That's the original meaning, at least at the time, of having territories. And as I will explain later, that language and that line of thinking, it's not what it's ruling right now and what the insular cases say. Obviously, when the United States started acquiring territories outside the mainland, all these territories were populated by different communities in evidence with different languages, customs, cultures, religions, and obviously legal systems. As you may know, the Spanish legal system is based on a civil code imported from France, from what is called the Code of Napoleon, right? And obviously, when the United States acquires these territories, their legal systems are not common law systems. So in that sense, academics and the courts started to question, how does the Constitution is gonna fit under those legal systems? Another interesting point it's that the territories, their acceptance of US governance, it varied. For example, the Philippines, after the Philippines was acquired, an insurrection broke out between 1899 and 1902, and that led to a conflict with the US Army. That didn't happen in Puerto Rico, but in Puerto Rico, the United States was generally welcomed with acceptance, and that those issues didn't happen here. So I'm going to give like a brief recount of the political and historical events that would shape the insular cases. The first one is the Carl Commission. That was a commission appointed by President McKinley after the war ended. And the point of the commission is that the conclusion of Henry Carroll, who was the chairman of the commission, concluded that Puerto Rico will become an integral part of the United States, apparently destined for statehood. And he recommended that Puerto Rico be given an organized government, because at the time, Puerto Rico was governed by a military government after the Treaty of Paris. The Carl Commission's findings led to what is called the Foraker Act. That act was passed in Congress in 1900, and it basically established the organized government in PR, and established also a United States District Court, a non-voting resident commissioner in DC, and it also created a tax on goods imported into Puerto Rico from the mainland. That is going to be important because most of the insular cases have to do with how the uniformity clause and tariff laws apply to territories. So that's an important issue to be considered in the insular cases. The last one is the Public Law 600. That it's, although it's not directly related to the insular cases, it's what gave path to the Commonwealth status that you guys hear about here in PR. That law basically authorized the Puerto Rican government to draft its own constitution and elect its own governor. And that act repealed some of the provisions of the Foraker Act and the Jones Act. Okay, so the Jones Act is the one that gave the citizenship to Puerto Ricans. So that's why, for example, Puerto Ricans serve in the armed forces, because of that act that provided for citizenship in Puerto Rico. And that's going to be really important too, because some people would argue that after the Jones Act, Congress incorporated Puerto Rico, as I would explain later. There's a distinction between unincorporated and incorporated territories, and that will define how the Constitution applies in either places. So that's something to have on top of your mind. So again, with the new territories now under the administration of the U.S., so the question is, does the Constitution file the flag? And the question and the answer is, it depends. And that's kind of, we're going to discuss that later. So as a present day textualist, which I am, I'm going to refer to you to the territorial clause. Clause says, Congress shall have power to dispose and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. So that's the clause that's going to be in the center of all litigation still to today around the territory. So if a territory's if someone in the territory is going to argue that a right of the Constitution applies to him or her, that's the interpretation of that right. It's going to be based on the Article 4, Section 3 of the Constitution, which is the territorial clause. So this is just an historical note. When the insular cases were decided, Dred Scott was still a valid precedent. And also the first line of cases were decided by the same, almost the same members of the Plessy versus Ferguson court. Another important note is that most of the insular cases were 5-4 outcomes with really, really long dissenting opinions from one judge called Justice Harlan. And that's something important because they were 5-4 outcomes, most of them. So the first case I'm going to discuss is called the Lima versus Bidwell. In that case, the controversy was whether Puerto Rico was a foreign country for purposes of tariff laws. What happened was that in that case, an importer of goods from Puerto Rico sought to recover duties paid on goods that he had brought in into the port of New York. And the collector said, no, you have to pay taxes because Puerto Rico is really a foreign country. So in that sense, there were questions about if a territory that is outside the mainland is it still a foreign country or not. And the court said, no, Puerto Rico is not a foreign country for purposes of tariff laws. Also, the court started to emphasize that the Constitution, as in Dred Scott, the Constitution did not allow Congress to hold territories in a permanent manner. The court even said that that conclusion would be an exercise of, and I quote, pure judicial legislation, and we find no warrant for it in the Constitution or in the powers conferred upon this court. That's something that I wanted to note, because later you're going to see that the court is going to start ignoring that language and establishing some distinctions that are not in the Constitution, and that will give rise to what we know today as the progeny of the insular cases and the precedents that govern territories to this date. The second case is Downs versus Bidwell. For me, this is the central case in establishing Puerto Rico's status and the status of other territories and within the American constitutional system. In that case, the controversy was regarding tax goods imported from Puerto Rico to New York, but now under the Foraker Act. As I mentioned earlier, the Foraker Act created a tax on goods imported from the island. So in that case, the court said that the uniformity clause didn't apply to Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico was not part of the United States. So now you will see a shift in the court's language and saying that locality, it's what's going to be really important when you say if a territory it's part of not or not of the United States. So now the conclusion of this case and the important thing is that locality is the thing that is going to determine how you treat a territory. in this case, and this is something I find really odd, and I think for present day originalists and textualists, it's problematic, is that Justice Brown, who was writing in the majority, said, and I quote, "The answer is not to be found in the Constitution itself, but rather in the nature of the government created by that instrument. In the practical construction put upon it by Congress and in the decisions of this court." So it's kind of a practical approach of seeing how the Constitution applies and how these people are going to fit, but not really about what the Constitution really says about territories. As I said, the Constitution doesn't create any distinction between territories. It only says territories, and that's something that case law before the insular cases really supported. So also in this case, and Justice White, and his view will prevail as the rule of the insular cases in the future. Justice White said that the application of the Constitution is going to depend on the kind of territory involved and the determination that was established by the Treaty of Acquisition. And he developed what is known to many of us and to the Supreme Court as the incorporation doctrine. He said that Puerto Rico was an incorporated territory, and in that sense, the Constitution would only apply with respect to fundamental restrictions. And he said that cannot be transgressed, although not expressed in so many words in the Constitution. I don't even know what that means, but that's the rule that the court will adopt in the future. I'm just gonna go quickly through the dissenting opinions. Justice Fuller and Justice Harlan use an approach for me more, how can I say it? It's not coherent, but it's just, it's according to the Constitution and to the text of the Constitution, I think it's a better approach. And that's the what the persons and litigants that try to fight the insular cases use, is that the Constitution really doesn't create a distinction between unincorporated and incorporated territories. And in that case, in particular, Justice Fuller, he used a case from the 1820s from Justice Marshall that had previously decided that the uniformity clause applied to the District of Columbia, which is also a territory, but not a territory in the sense of being outside the mainland. So Justice Fuller said, so if we decide that for the District of Columbia, I mean, this is already decided. You cannot just ignore the Blake case from 1820. Later on, the composition of the court will change with Justice Wendell Holmes and Justice William Day. And a debate started around what's the meaning of providing citizenship to inhabitants in the territories. So there's a case called Mankishi. And in Mankishi, the court decided that the U.S. had incorporated Hawaii after citizenship was granted in 1900. So now the question is whether other territories that are granted citizenship, the court has to decide whether Congress incorporated those territories. And it's maybe logical to conclude that if Congress grants citizenship to people in a territory, it's reasonable to argue that Congress has incorporated those persons, because I don't see any other reason of why Congress would do that. Some argue that Congress did it because they were thinking about Second World War and stuff like that. But at the time, there was no evidence of that. And so there's a case in Puerto Rico that resolved that issue. And it's called Balzac versus People of Puerto Rico. In that case, inhabitant of Puerto Rico, he requested a jury trial pursuant to the Sixth Amendment. And he said, okay, after the Jones Act in 1917, which I mentioned earlier, Congress incorporated Puerto Rico, and he argued now the Constitution applies fully to the island because we are now deemed incorporated because we are citizens. And the court said, no, you were not incorporated and you have no right to a jury trial under the Sixth Amendment. And this case was an unanimous decision by the Supreme Court, and Chief Justice Taft was writing for the majority. And also in this case, the court reaffirmed that the important thing is locality of the territory. And it said, it is locality that it's determinative of the application in such matters as judicial procedure and not the status of the people who live in it. So in that sense, the court also created a distinction between substantive rights and procedural rights. And because the court deemed the trial by jury right as the procedural right, then the court concluded that Balzac didn't have that right in the territory. The court also made a couple of expressions that obviously were just because of the historical times and the composition of the court. The court said that Puerto Ricans were foreign to the jury system, and that was also part of why they were not going to be good jurors, in other words. But Harlan wasn't on the court. But some people say that Harlan would have said, but Puerto Ricans have been serving as juries since 1901 because they had a district court there. And in the district court, you do have a trial by jury right. And obviously that wasn't the case. The Supreme Court thought that Puerto Ricans were foreign to the jury system. And now I obviously think about how can we reconcile Balzac with the Mancisci case that concluded that Hawaii was incorporated by the citizenship when citizenship was granted. But I don't have an answer for that. I don't think there's no way of reconciling those cases. So the test that the Balzac case created was that only fundamental personal rights would apply to unincorporated territories. And obviously you're gonna ask, what are those fundamental personal rights? So that will be up to the Supreme Court to decide. And that's why there's more cases trying to understand what those rights are. So I'm just going to mention a couple of those cases just for before opening the debate. The first case is Flores de Otero. In that case, the court decided that the rights guaranteed by the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the Due Process Clause of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment apply to residents of Puerto Rico because they are fundamental rights. Also, in Califano versus Torres, the court said that a woman who qualified for benefits under the SSI program, that's the Supplemental Security Income Program, she could have them withdrawn when she moved back to Puerto Rico, just because Congress could discriminate because of the locality test, right? And also Harris versus Rosario was also a case involving 8-2 families with dependent children. In that case, the court said that a woman didn't have the right to have the same payments as she would have had in the mainland because Congress only needed a rational basis to treat territories unequally. Also, I want to note that we should not mix the fundamental rights approach with the fundamental rights under the 14th Amendment that the U.S. Supreme Court has incorporated to the states and territories, right, under that clause. So, for example, the Second Amendment, because it has been incorporated in the McDonald case, it applies to territories also because the 14th Amendment has been held to apply to territories. So I just want to make that clear because sometimes people just confuse the fundamental rights under both approaches and clauses. There has been a lot of recent developments regarding the insular cases and also other topics, especially regarding the debt crisis here in the island. But I just want to point out three cases, and one of them is currently pending before the Supreme Court, and my office filed an amicus brief in support of a respondent in that case. The first one is Puerto Rico versus Sanchez Valle. In that case, the controversy was whether the double jeopardy clause applied to Puerto Rico when the local government tries to prosecute a person for the same offense after the federal authorities have also convicted that person. And in that case, the court said that Puerto Rico and the federal government are not separate sovereigns. So in that sense, the court said, even after Puerto Ricans started to elect their own governor in 1950, even when they were able to draft their own constitution because Congress allowed for it, even when that happened in the 1950s, the authority to prosecute is the same. So if the government, if the local government prosecutes someone and that person has been convicted or accused in the federal court, that person would be entitled to double jeopardy protections. The second one is the Financial Oversight Board case. As you may know, after 2016, with the debt crisis, it didn't start, right? But all the litigation regarding the debt crisis started in 2016. At that time, President Obama sign into law what it's called PROMESA. It's the Puerto Rico Oversight Management and Economic Stability Act. And in that law, Congress allowed for the president to appoint 7 members to a board, which would be commanded to negotiate the debt with all the creditors here in the island. So the question was where the appointments clause barred the president from appointing those officials without the Senate's consent. And the court said that even when the appointment clause constrains the appointments, even in the territories, the territorial clause allows Congress to insert local officials in territorial governments. And the court said that even when the board was an entity created by Congress, it was part of the local government. And because of that, the president's appointments did not violate the appointments clause. So in that sense, you're going to note Congress under the insular cases has the power to even alter the governmental structure of a territory. Congress can say, I'm going to insert an official, I'm going to insert even a new governor. That's possible under the analysis that the insular cases follow. The last one, and with this case I conclude, is United States versus Baello Madero. That's the one that is pending before the Supreme Court. That's similar to the Califano case. And in this case, a resident from New York also moved to the island after receiving SSI payments. And after he moved to the island from 2013 to 2016, he was still receiving payments, and he was sued by the federal government because the government wanted to recover all those payments that he received while in the island. In that case, both the district court and the First Circuit concluded that treatment violated the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause under the argument that the Constitution prohibits Congress from using the harm of a political unpopular group as a basis for discrimination. The First Circuit also said that the reasons Congress used for that treatment did not meet the rational basis standard. And it also said that the exclusion was a de facto classification based on Hispanic origin. The government appealed, and the Supreme Court granted cert last year, and the case is now before the court. This case is directly tied to the insular cases, not like the Sanchez Valle and the Oversight Board case. Even thought in those cases, people argue the insular cases, that's really a collateral issue, and the court has not addressed that issue recently. So I think the Baello Madero case presents an opportunity for the court to talk about the insular cases. And I don't really know what the court is going to do. But whatever happens, the future of Puerto Rico status, I think it's going to be, as the cases say, up to Congress. And it's going to come from the political arena. It's not going to come from the courts. And that's all I got. I mean, just I don't know if I think we have 14 minutes for questions, Seth. And I think that's all I got.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for that, Omar. And it's very enlightening. I learned quite a bit. Interestingly enough, as you mentioned in your comments, At least for me at law school, none of these cases, one or two of the cases I remember hearing about, but for instance, Jones Act and other legislative actions that more or less created the relationship, established the relationship between Puerto Rico and the United States as it exists today, entirely unknown. So thank you so much for sharing these comments. At this point, I would like to open up to any questions that our participants have. Because of the nature of the Zoom presentation mode, I cannot, nor can Omar see you. So I'd ask you to, if you have a question, to unmute, to please ask the question, and then to then remute your mic to allow our speaker an opportunity to answer. Okay, well, it sounds like we don't have any questions. Omar, is there anything else you might like to add before we conclude today?
No, I mean, I don't know. I just want to say that I mean, there's a lot of debate surrounding the insular cases. And, you know, it's a really divisive issue here. Whether Puerto Rico has been incorporated or not and stuff like that. But Puerto Ricans are really happy with their American citizenship and happy to serve in the military and all of that. But there's a lot of debate surrounding the insular cases and whether Puerto Rico has been incorporated or not. So that's a hot button issue here. And I hope you folks are interested in just... Seeing what happens in the future.
Well, certainly after listening to the conversation today, I am going to read your materials further in depth. I started to read them this week and did not get through everything, but I got through quite a bit of them. I did notice that we had, Zana, thank you so much. There is a question in the Q&A box, so let me bear with me one moment, please. Q&A box, I see this. Blair Gardner. Blair, thank you for the question. Blair's question to you, Omar, is, are there any cases pre-Dred Scott that are informative about the nature of federal authority over its territories?
I think that Dred Scott is probably the most cited cases. I don't know about any other case which the controversy was really the territorial clause. Because, for example, there was a lot of litigation surrounding if Congress had the authority to prohibit slavery in some parts of the U.S., as in Missouri, for example. And that gave rise to the Dred Scott case. But I don't know about any other case that at the time really addressed the issue. I don't know any other case.
Okay. Give a moment here for anyone else to type a question and answer, or excuse me, a question, and allow our panelists to answer. All right. Well, with that, I want to thank everyone for participating today. It really is an unbelievable honor to be able to have speakers like Omar participate with our group. I mean, I'm sitting here in Evansville, Indiana. I see that we've got Andy Ozak here in Evansville, Blair's up in Northern Indiana. Our other participants, forgive me, I know that a couple of you are local, but I know that we have some folks that as a result of COVID and doing these presentations by Zoom are able to participate. I want to thank you all for taking time away. We are just very happy to be able to provide this. You know, our goal is of a lawyers chapter here in Evansville is to cultivate a marketplace of ideas. You know, we're the only organization outside of the Bar Association, which does a great job that seeks to do this. And we typically do try and get continuing legal ed credits. Post-pandemic, the state bar has asked the additional provisions be taken so that we can prove attendance virtually. And so I'm going to be working with them and the FedSoc home office, which has been awesome. Zana and her team have always been awesome to get that. Stay tuned for our next installment, which will be in May. We will be hosting live in May, Nadine Strossen, professor of law at NYU, former president of the ACLU, who, you know, ends up more or less at the same point that many libertarians and conservatives end up on the principles of free speech. This is a program that has been 2 years in the making. We initially had conversations with Nadine first quarter 2020. Everyone remembers what happened second quarter of 2020. And so we've been working with Nadine in communication with her since first quarter 2020. This is going to be May the 12th. It is a Thursday. It's going to be in person live here in Evansville. We will have it with food. So bear in mind that that will be happening in May. Omar, thanks again for taking time out of your day to present. And with this, we are concluded. Thank you so much to everyone for participating.